Hello, I'm Tim Bowes. Welcome to the Net Hero Podcast, the podcast about net zero. People, places, the things that are going on to change our world. But before we get on to this week's episode, two things to mention. One, our brand new website, futurenetzero.com. Go to it. It's got the tools to help you, particularly our learning and index sections that will really help you get to understand technologies that will help you get to cutting your emissions today. There's plenty more on that platform, including obviously the podcast and lots of great advice and inspiring stories. And the second thing is a date for your diary. The Big Zero Show is back, bigger and better than ever before. July the 2nd and 3rd at the Coventry Business Arena. Day one is all about business, 5 years on from the Net Zero Declaration. And day two is about skills and how young people and older people can reskill. Giving back on day two, making business on day one. It's all part of what we're trying to produce here at Future Net Zero. Now, on to this week's Net Hero podcast. I knew this moment would come. I can't believe it, 30 odd years later. I read a book, I think it was 92, called Jurassic Park. You probably know it. There's a man in it called Richard Hammond, played by Dickie Attenborough. And we all know what happens in Jurassic Park. You go and make dinosaurs. Now, a brilliant story, a great movie. Some of them have been pants, let's be honest. But could it actually be reality? Could we bring back species? Now, I know what you're thinking. What the hell have I been taking? And I'm telling you, I haven't been taking anything. But there's a company out there that's on a path to do exactly that. Not exactly dinosaurs. They're looking at bringing back things like the dodo and the woolly mammoth. And I just thought, this has got to be listened to. So it is my pleasure to welcome Ben Lamb, co-founder and CEO of Colossal Biosciences. Ben, what can I say? Da, da, da,
da, da. Yeah, believe it or not. So first of all, thanks for having me. Believe it or not, we may have heard the Jurassic Park reference.
Really? No, I can't.
A time or
that.
Two. Yeah, and we constantly get given either books or memorabilia. So people did. The movie definitely made quite an impact. And so the technologies are similar, but you know the mission is quite different since we're more focused on conservation.
I know. I'm just thinking of that scene. You must have seen where he goes, hey, this isn't like condors. You know, if I bring back condors, they were selected for discus.
You know, I don't know if there's a Jurassic Park meme that I have not texted or emailed. So
let's park this. Okay, let's get into the reality of this. Why the hell are you on a Net Zero podcast? So the reason is what you're actually creating from what I've got, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is you're looking at a way of conserving sort of the biosphere, and in particular animals that are on the risk of extinction. And the reason that you say this matters is that if you preserve the animals, then that helps to preserve the ecosystems, which helps to regulate what's going on with our environment and our climate. Have I got that right? Is that where you're coming from?
You are spot on. You know, we are facing not just a climate crisis, but a biodiversity crisis. We're going to lose up to 50% of all biodiversity between now and 2050 if we don't do anything. So Colossal decided to, George Church and I decided to build a company that we could go focus on building a systems model of thinking towards conservation by focusing first on de-extinction and then making sure that all the technologies that we develop on the path to de-extinction can be directly applied to species preservation today. And so we think that de-extinction and species preservation go hand in hand. And it's fundamentally important for us to, you know, build technologies and give conservationists new tools in the fight against loss of biodiversity and ecosystem restoration versus what we're currently doing. Because current conservation, while it works, it doesn't work fast enough compared to what we are doing to the planet.
Let's just stop because I want to go into what you're doing, and it is fascinating, and we'll talk about the mammoth and we'll talk about the dodo. But the fundamental point you're making there, where do you correlate? I get it. Animal conservation is fine. We all want to do that. But people would say, well, there's no point conserving more pandas if we're destroying the environment of the pandas?
Yeah.
Right? If we lose the rainforest, then it doesn't matter how many sloths you bring back, there's nowhere for them to live. So how are you equating what you're trying to do as de-extinction science with preserving the environment? Do you know what I mean? I can see them as two separate things.
No, absolutely. So when a keystone species is removed from the environment, that environment starts to change. If you look at some of the largest rewilding projects that have been successful in time, look at Yellowstone here in the United States. Yeah. Look at the rewilding of the wolves.
The wolves, so absolutely. Yeah, it's a really famous story.
They culled the wolves. Yeah. They got rid of the wolves because there's a fear that like predators are bad. Actually, predators are quite good. Large herbivores like mammoth and bison and other species, and animals like thylacines and wolves, apex predators, are incredibly important to the ecosystem. They keep, most people think if you remove a predator, there'll be more animals. That's actually couldn't be more opposite. If you remove a predator, there's actually less animals because what happens is everything gets out of balance. Nature is an incredible way of balancing the ecosystem, and a more balanced ecosystem has a higher rate of oxygen-nitrogen turnover. And it also has shown that it has incredible ways of sequestering carbon, and in some cases, even methane in the Arctic. And so for us, we want to help preserve keystone species that are in danger of being critical, in danger of going extinct today, that are critically endangered. Or we also want to help bring back keystone species that have been lost to help revitalize those ecosystems, like the Tasmanian tiger in Tasmania in southern Australia, as well as the mammoth for the Arctic slope.
So the point being that you talk about the Yellowstone example, which is fascinating. The wolves came back and then there was a change in predation. There was a change of different species, but it actually affected the flora as well as the fauna, didn't it?
It reshaped, it even reshaped rivers. There's a whole great movie online about it. I sometimes tell people that, like, did you know that there's more fish in Yellowstone because of wolves?
Yes,
and that just blows people's minds.
Yeah. So do you think that the premise, which is try and save species, can counteract our things like deforestation or over agriculture? Because that's a different point to say, isn't it?
It's a great point, right? I'm an eternal optimist, right? Yeah. But there's no silver bullet to there's no silver bullet to the climate or biodiversity crisis other than massively changing hearts and minds. Yeah. Now, what's also unique about this project outside of the technologies that we're developing for conservation is we are inspiring people. Like we are getting, like we get pictures from like parents of like kids drawing mammoths and saying, will I ever get to see one in my lifetime? Or thank you for doing this, right? So I will say that Colossal is bringing a lot of attention, given that we're working on mammoths and dodos, to the loss of biodiversity crisis, right? And so I don't think that Colossal is a silver bullet to the climate or the biodiversity crisis. But what I will say is, you know, I hope that we are one thread in a tapestry of threads in a tapestry of technologies that can then be applied to biodiversity loss and fighting climate change. We're just one, though. We're not going to save everything, but we hope that maybe we inspire others that would, you know, come to de-extinction and also look at biodiversity loss.
I suppose the thing is, you've got it. Let's be honest, right? A mammoth is sexy, right? Dodo, maybe not as much, but definitely they're sort of advert poster animals.
Dodos are sexy.
But you're looking at the other species that people, you know, whether it's a frog or whatever, these things that don't get the publicity. Let's just go back before we talk about what you're doing. You're not a biologist and you're not a geneticist. So your background is technology, right? So what got you into this? Are you coming from kind of an AI thing, or was it just kind of some
I built a couple of tech. So my background is in building teams of much smarter women and men than me, right? I just try to work with really smart people on interesting projects. And so I had a satellite software and defense company in the United States. Uh-huh. I had a conversational intelligence company. I had a gaming company. So things, it's funny, I built a couple of AI companies before AI was as sexy. You know, I probably should have just done it now because someone would give me like $1 billion to go build.
Yeah.
I built three AI companies. And so, my background is mostly in systems design. And so while I'm not a biologist, or a geneticist.
Yes.
I met this guy, George Church, mm-hmm. who's the father of synthetic biology. You know, he helped invent a lot of the core technologies for reading and writing the genome. Interesting Jurassic Park fact for you, since you started with that.
Yeah.
In Michael Crichton's book that you read, there's a genetic sequence. That is actually the work that George published in the 70s. So if anything, we weren't inspired by Jurassic Park. Michael Crichton may have been inspired by George.
No, I remember when
crazy.
It is tough. I remember when, you know, I was at the BBC at the time working when they sequenced the human genome, right? And I think it was 2000, 2001. And that was incredible. And so this genetics, but what I'm trying to get to is you could be doing any other thing, like you said.
Yeah.
If you got an interest in the nature side of things, the biology side, or was it just a fascination with George that led to this?
No. So I met George, I reached out to George about something totally tangential. I asked, I wanted to build synthetic biology software platforms.
Okay.
Because I do think that the intersection right now of AI, automation, and synthetic biology, being able to read and write genomes, and then how is that even affected in the future with new technologies like quantum? I think that we're at this, like we're literally standing in the doorstep of technology. Like I think that the biotechnology revolution through synthetic biology will dwarf the AI revolution that we're currently starting in. And so I think there's lots of really interesting opportunities for humanity in this. So obviously from an entrepreneur perspective and loving new technology trends, I was attracted to that. But in my last company, we actually built a photobioreactor leveraging AI and robotics that could sequester as much carbon as 400 trees. It ended up being put in the Smithsonian as a technology innovation to combat climate change. And so I just got really fascinated in saying, how can we use some of these technologies to solve problems, not just, you know, build companies and make money? And so when I was talking to George about algae, he was like, well, have you ever thought about conservation and de-extinction? And George was the one that really started talking to me about how important the biodiversity loss was and how we could reverse it and build technologies to help empower conservationists. So George definitely kind of wrapped me into this. But then the further I went down the rabbit hole, I just wanted to keep taking more of the red pills.
We're getting every movie we can in this one. Are you an eco bunny? Have you always had a fascination with nature? Or as you say, is this come about because of these conversations?
No, I was very fortunate to spend a lot of time as a child traveling. So I've got to see, I spent a lot of time in Africa as a child, spent a lot of time. So I've been around nature my entire life and been around animals. I think that my house had like every kind of animal growing up. And so I've always loved animals. I've always loved nature, but I went the traditional technology route, right? Is for a career and as a passion. And so now I'm kind of getting to mix
bringing it back. Yeah.
Yeah. Which is, I will tell you, I'm working harder than I've ever worked, but I'm having more fun than I've ever had.
Right. Let's do the science bit, everyone. Okay. Yeah. How the hell are you doing any of this stuff? So let's talk about the two projects that I think most people would be listening to this thing. One is the woolly mammoth and two is the dodo. Let's start with that. Why the hell a woolly mammoth? Now, my little one loves Ice Age. It's a great movie. Manny's a miserable bugger and I love him. We already have elephants. Why are you not saving more African elephants? Why the hell try and bring back a woolly mammoth?
So a couple of things, right? So one, George had been working on the woolly mammoth for 8 years. So if I wanted to get George and wanted to get all the technologies to do this, starting with the woolly mammoth made a lot of sense.
Okay.
But that was just kind of the practical side. What I didn't realize is that the path to the woolly mammoth actually, I didn't realize at the time, obviously now it's kind of core to our mission, was that the path to the mammoth not only would be able to create these Arctic adapted elephants that we can put back in an area where there wouldn't be lots of human elephant conflict, right? Because the population density areas out there are much less than in India and other locations, right? And it could also help revitalize that degraded ecosystem. So I found that really fascinating. But also to your question about the African elephants, there's not a lot of research that's gone into elephant developmental biology. So Colossal could help not only bring back mammoths, but we could help transform saving elephants. So one interesting fact that a project that we're working on is called EEHV. You probably don't know this, but there's because I didn't know this before I started the company. It's a deadly herpes virus that kills 20% of baby elephants every single year. More than poaching. The number one killer of elephants is EEHV. And guess what? It's eradicatable. You can eradicate it with an mRNA vaccine and some genetic engineering. But, you know, if we're going to make mammoths, we don't want 20% of our population, of our babies, to be susceptible to this awful, terrible disease. And so we're working to eradicate EEHV. We're actually pretty close on it. We're doing some clinical trials right now on it. And once we get a little bit further, we're going to open source that to the world. And so that will, like, if Colossal does nothing else but just cure EEHV, we will have done more to save existing elephants than all elephant conservation worldwide. And so that's the kind of magnitude of some of the science that's coming out of the Mammoth Project for conservation today.
Right. I want to talk about the mammoth, making the mammoth, in a minute.
Yeah.
Let's think about where they'll go and why. So obviously, the Ice Age ended about 10,000 years ago, give or take, depending where you are on the planet Earth. They were everywhere. We now have the Arctic, which is basically a sea, or we have solid land in Antarctica. So if you do get them to come to life, where would you stick them?
Yeah, so we would definitely focus on the Arctic Circle and Circle Polar North, which is a little bit bigger. What people don't still realize, because we're looking at climate change and all these other issues facing our planet, what most people don't realize is that during the Ice Age in the last 100,000 years, so pre the end of the last Ice Age, during the Pleistocene and then into the early Holocene era, there were actually periods of interglacial periods that were even warmer than today.
Yes.
Yeah. It's actually not as warm. And mammoths showed up about 2.5, 2.6 million years ago is generally when we think as the scientific community thinks mammoths showed up. And what they've also found is they had incredibly diverse and incredibly distant migratory patterns. So we actually find mammoths and even subspecies of mammoths, like Colombian mammoths and others, but we also see the woolly mammoths, even as far south as like Texas and Mexico and a lot of different places, which is really interesting because during these different interglacial periods, it was actually as warm and even warmer as it is today. And so mammoths actually had a much broader range of migration than
we
people
think.
Realize.
Right. Yeah.
And well, they also could exist in much warmer climates.
Wow.
And one of our partners in Canada actually has Asian elephants, which you would think of as like, oh, that's a tropical, that could never be outside. We actually have videos with them where they're like breaking through the ice and swimming and playing in the snow. So mammoths and elephants were actually, they're pretty temperate animals. They can be in a large variety. And, you know, it still gets to negative 40 in many parts of the Arctic Circle. And so most of that kind of zero to negative 20 degrees Fahrenheit is where a lot of mammoths existed in the winter months, but it got much warmer. And so the ecosystem that could support them still exists. And we actually have a scientific paper that's in peer review right now. That's a mammoth capacity paper of what latitudes and what's the density of mammoths we could put back to make an impact both from a climate perspective and ecosystem restoration perspective, but also a thriving of the animals themselves. So that's in peer review. Hopefully in the next couple of months it comes out and we're happy to share it.
And just before we talk about the process, you're looking at just the Arctic or you're looking at the Antarctic as well? Was that more difficult because you've got the penguins and there's an ecosystem?
Yeah, you don't have vegetation, right?
Yeah.
And so we are looking at mostly the Arctic and Circle Polar North on mammoth.
How are you going to build it? Now, Jurassic Park, they take a gene sequence of frogs. They take the DNA from a dinosaur that's in amber, right? We've had a few skeletons. We've had a few kind of preserved in the permafrost mammoths. How are you going to make one?
So, by the way, just for another fun fact, not that we've tried, but amber is a terrible storage vehicle for DNA.
Don't spoil the story.
I just want to make sure people know that, like, you know, if you're collecting amber for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, don't do that.
Not a dinosaur will make.
No.
It's a great question. And so think of it as, like, in a weird way, as like reverse Jurassic Park. They were taking dino DNA and sticking frog DNA in it.
Yeah.
We're not taking mammoth DNA and sticking and filling the holes with elephant DNA.
Right.
The closest living relative to a woolly mammoth is the Asian elephant.
Right.
It's 99.6% the same.
Fine. So you start with that.
And they're actually closer related to mammoths than than Asian elephants are to African elephants.
That's really interesting. That's mind-blowing.
Super crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and so we start with the Asian elephant genome. We actually have about 60 mammoth genomes we've gotten from, like, the tundra, from the Arctic, some museums. And we actually take different samples, and we can actually use AI and software, kind of some of my background, to understand and reassemble the ancient DNA. And then we map it onto the Asian elephant to identify what genes made a mammoth. And then instead of trying to fill in so many holes, we just take those genes and engineer them into the Asian elephant. And then after that, we use a process called cloning, which is also known as somatic cell nuclear transfer, which they did with Dolly the sheep. And we take the nucleus of one cell and we put it into an egg cell. And then we just put that egg cell into a surrogate, in this case, the Asian elephant. And 22 months later, if everything goes well, we have a mammoth.
So just to recap, what you're saying is you're going to start with the Asian elephant. And what you're going to do is, because you've got those gene samples, you'll find a way of where those genes have to be turned on to make. Mm-hmm. So are you going to actually make new DNA? That's what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So yes. So, and where we are in the process is we've already done all of that. We're actually editing. We're in the editing phase right now. And so people talk about things like CRISPR and all these other tools for genetic engineering. Mm-hmm. We actually use all of them. So to your question about making DNA, sometimes it's easy to make one little change. Yeah. Sometimes it's easier to synthesize and actually make an entire strand of DNA and plug it in. So we're using, that's called DNA synthesis. And we do that and some protein engineering around this as well. So we're actually engineering pieces of DNA based on what we find in the mammoth genome. And then we insert it into the Asian elephant genome.
So the idea is a surrogate elephant, normal elephant that you'd see in India or Thailand or whatever, will eventually give birth to a woolly calf. And you're saying to me, I think before we start recording, you're hoping to have one by 2028, which is not far away. Okay.
Yeah, which is not far away. Because part of our thought process with building the company, given my background in software, is it, we kind of runs like a tech company and we do a lot of parallel pathing. So we're not waiting until we have we didn't wait until we had the genomic sequence to start building the genetic engineering tools or the elephant cells. We parallel path everything. And, you know, our stem cell group just made a lot of exciting press recently with the advancement that they got to stem cells in elephants, which is the first time anyone's ever been able to achieve that. And so we're making a lot of progress and we are on track for 2028.
People will be saying, why are you doing this? Why are you fiddling? Why are you playing God? And I know you probably get that criticism a lot. A lot of people, Dolly the sheep was big, it was here in the UK. And I remember covering at the time. And, there was a lot of, it was a miracle and a lot of consternation.
It was a miracle based on the technology they had to do it.
In 96. It was a miracle. Yeah, absolutely.
It was truly a miracle.
How do you answer that moral question, which is, why are you fiddling with this? The risks of some sort of genetic mutation, the risk that the animal, it's not from this time, right? There's that classic thing, which is you're bringing back something that died out 10 to 25,000 years ago, whatever it was.
So mammoths only died out about 3,500 years ago. This is also kind of interesting. We were building the pyramids while there were mammoths on the planet. Most people don't realize that. It's not 65 million years old, right? It did not die with the dinosaurs.
And I know we've interacted with them. We hunted them, all of that. Yeah, we've got all that.
Yeah, we did. We actually helped drive them to extinction. And so look at this. I think we have a moral obligation not only to not fiddle with it, but to actually do it, because we can leverage these technologies for conservation. We can also, undo the sins of the past. And if you really look at like the argument about playing God, we play God every time we eradicate a species or we cut down a forest or take medicine, right? So I think that we have a responsibility to be good stewards of this planet. And if we can use human ingenuity and technologies to reverse some of the sins of the past, then I don't think it's just a question of if we should do it. I think we have a moral obligation to do it. I think it's immoral with the biodiversity crisis that we're at to not pursue technologies like de-extinction, because it's better to have a de-extinction toolkit and not need it than not have a de-extinction toolkit and need it. And that is the path that we are on.
How have you got around the issue around cloning? Because obviously there are a lot of protocols, particularly in the UK. I'm not fully aware of the US legislation, but at the end of the day, to clone has inherent risks of how sustainable that life, that organism will be and all of that. So where are you with that and legislative wise?
Yeah, it's a great question. And so we work very closely with all of our federal agencies here in the United States, and also international governments and partners. You know, one of the things that we try to do is we not only just have conversations like this, but we try to be pretty transparent. We want to be an open book. Anytime you do anything this big or bold, I think it's your responsibility to be transparent to the public.
Absolutely.
And answer the hard questions. So cloning's come a long way, right? Like with Dolly, you know, like I said, it was a miracle. The fact that that worked, and they were like jamming, so like it was crazy. It's come so far. So for example, they were using bad old, like there was a lot of, like I said, the fact that it works is a miracle. But today we're actually even using things like lasers and robotics. So we actually use lasers to drill into the zone of the outside of that egg, outside of that wall, suck the DNA out with robotics.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly precise. If you come to the lab, we'll actually let you do it. It's pretty awesome. And then put that in, and literally, so we're using like laser drills and robotics to do that entire process. And the cloning efficiencies that we're seeing are in the high 70s, which is unheard of. You know, a long time ago, if you look at the historics of cloning, some of the success rates were 2%.
Yeah, absolutely. There was, again, the moral argument of how many animals or creatures you've killed in the process of making one that's viable.
Yeah, but once again, what's great is we're only working in cells. So we are not killing any animals. Yep. We're taking ancient genes and inserting them into cell lines. So we're not actually harming any animals in the process. Animal welfare is very, very important to kind of like our belief. You know, if we weren't, like going back to your Jurassic Park analogy, I don't think that they were in it for the conservation benefits. No.
They're in it for the theme park, yeah.
it'd be hard for us to be in it for the conservation benefits,
yeah,
if we weren't focusing on the animals. But all the work we do is in cells, not in, you know, full adult animals.
And I know that the laws, as I said earlier, are different. So you've gone through the process, and in the US, what you're doing, the federal, the local governments are saying, yeah, that's okay, we can do that.
Yes, yeah. So we are very transparent. We actually meet quarterly with the federal government here in the United States and keep them updated and apprised to our progress.
What stage are you at now? Have you got cells that have got the nucleus with a mix of the normal elephant DNA and all that?
So on the Mammoth project specifically, we've built a reference genome for the Asian elephant. We've built a reference genome for all of these closest living relatives. We've built reference genomes for the mammoth. We've done all the comparative genomics. There's about 85 genes that we're editing. And, you know, we've made over 30 edits in the cells. And so, and then we've also created induced pluripotent stem cells from elephants. That allows us to reprogram those cells into even egg cells. So we won't even have to harvest egg cells from elephants.
Yeah, I was going to say that. So brilliant. Right. Okay.
No, we're going to be able to make our own egg cells in a lab, right? And so, which is massively helpful for conservation. And another project that we're working on is the Northern White Rhino, where they're exclusive genetic rescue partner.
Yeah.
And they're having to extract those egg cells, where we're going to use our technology to help them make their own egg cells so they don't ever have to extract them from the animal itself, right? So that not only helps conservation, but that's an animal welfare issue as well. So we're in the editing phase. So right now, you know, we are on track, you know, for our 2028 deadline. We feel confident in where we are. There's still a lot of work to do, and this is hard, and so it could slip. But right now, we feel pretty confident, given that we're in that middle stage. We're in the editing part of the project.
I mean, it's fascinating. I'm sure people will be divided, right? I kind of think there are merits for it. There are things that I would question about it as well. But
yeah,
the point before we end, I want to cover off, which is, say you're successful. And you do create a mammoth, okay? And that mammoth then, how are you going to train this animal? Because its mum will be a normal elephant. It's going to be something very different. Its behavior patterns, no one knows how mammoths behaved. We can just look at things. So do you know what I mean? I'm just trying to work out, as you do this,
it's a great question. And to your point about critics, you know, we have a history of running towards the critics. I think we're better today.
No, yeah, I'm serious.
I think we're better today than we were on day one, because some of our biggest critics are now part of the company, because we went and asked them, wait, what are we doing wrong? Uh-huh. We want to learn. So these types of dialogues and questions are so important to what we're...
So have you looked at the behavioral side of it and what it was?
Yes. So two projects that we are funding and also supporting in Africa. One is a herd dynamics and migratory patterns in Kenya. And then we're also working with the largest elephant orphanage in Botswana. So right. We're using AI and computer vision and drones, which we're building and funding, to understand how to reintroduce elephant orphans back into herds in the social pattern of elephants.
Gotcha.
That's not only helpful for our rewilding aspects of the mammoth, but that's also really helpful for us understanding how to help elephants that exist today. And so there's a lot of really great cognitive studies around different animal groups, not enough in elephants, but we're changing that. And so by the time that we get our first calves and the time that they get reach a point of maturity that we can reintroduce them, we want to make sure that we understand enough about elephant socialization, orphanage, and herd dynamics and migratory patterns that they can be successfully reintroduced back in the wild.
So that the idea would they'd be a surrogate herd for them of normal elephants.
Oh, yeah, exactly. And they will learn from each other. Yeah. But some of that is also programmed in, right? And so for us, not making a mammoth is the success. Reintroducing the animals back into the wild with sustainable populations, that's how we define success, not making a mammoth.
You've done the mammoth, and as I said, it's sexy and it's great. I assume the idea is to try and apply this to things that we know are under threat. You mentioned rhinos. There are loads of species of birds, loads of other mammals, fish. God knows what we're destroying.
Yeah. Pretty much everything.
Pretty much everything. You're going to make money, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's cool. But a lot of the places where these things matter are very poor parts of the world. Now, you talk about one of the things you want to do is work with indigenous people, and you want to do stuff to make this, you said earlier, I want to open it up. So what is the vision in terms of how you allow this science, that you don't go down the big pharma road of kind of, hey, we made the drug, and by the way, for you in India or Indonesia, whatever, it's $400 million to get an elephant. How are you going to do this to help where the issues are with the diversity, which is generally the global south?
Yeah, so I would bifurcate that question and say that all of the technologies that have an application to human healthcare, we are monetizing. We're spinning those out. We don't want to distract us, right? And so we launched our first company last year, Form Bio, which is focusing on leveraging AI and software to do comparative genomics, which can be applied to human healthcare, cancer research, and others, right? So not only can that make money, but that can actually help human healthcare. Gotcha. So we spin those companies out. Different money goes into that from our, we don't put our own money in it. New money goes into that. And we put a leadership team in. And then, you know, that's great from an investment perspective for us and our investors. But then all of the applications for conservation, that helps subsidize that all those technologies, those same technologies can be open source to our conservation partners. And so we want to give all of the conservation partners access to all of the technologies that we make so that they can use them and improve them, because there's not enough money going into conservation, especially in poor areas like you mentioned. And let me tell you what there's also not going in. If there's not money going into existing conservation, there's not money going into research and development. And as a technology entrepreneur, research and development is fucking expensive.
Yeah, it is.
It's hard. And most people just think it's easy. But the research, the R and the R&D is a big R and it's a little D, right?
It's a little D, exactly.
Yeah. But fundamentally, like, not everything that you research works. And so I look at Colossal as almost like a conservation research and development arm that's free to conservation.
It's a weird one. I really am.
It's weird. Yeah. It's like, it's not your everyday project.
It's not your everyday project. It's not your everyday, let's build a kind of sanctuary for a few little creatures. I think it's incredibly fascinating. I think everyone will be really interested to see how things progress. A couple of things that really, I suppose we should end with, you're privately funded, but you've actually got, I think you said, one of the states in America, the actual state has invested in this. We haven't got time for it, but you're looking at dodos, you're looking, you said, at Tasmanian devil.
Yes, we have three. We have the mammoth, the thylacine, also known as Tasmanian tiger, and the dodo project. So we have about 130 scientists working on those three projects.
And have you started looking at anything that's just living today but endangered? You mentioned rhinos, or are you just trying to work on these sort of core species first?
So we're working on the pink pigeon in Mauritius in collaboration with Mauritian Wildlife Foundation. So each one of our de-extinction projects, we try to attach it to a critically endangered species.
Gotcha.
We're working with the northern quoll in Australia, which is a carnivorous marsupial like the thylacine, so which is critically endangered. So we're working on that. And then we're working on in Africa on two different African elephant projects. And then we're working on the northern white rhino project with Dr. Thomas Hildebrandt, and we're their genetic rescue partner.
Ben, it's been fascinating. My last question, you're not bringing back a velociraptor, are you?
We're not. It is not possible to de-extinct dinosaurs.
I think it's fascinating, Ben Lamb. I think what you're doing is brave, crazy, and could fundamentally shift the world that we're living in. So best of luck. Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
No problems. What do you think? I mean, you've got to have a view on that podcast. Flipping it. Get in touch. nethero@futurenetzero.com. Drop us a line. Check out Colossal. See what they're doing. And Ben, I'm sure we'll stay in touch because I think this is one that's going to run and run. So it's a story that we need to follow. Thank you very much.
You've just heard the Net Hero podcast from futurenetzero.com. Join us as we help you find ways to cut your carbon footprint as we head towards net zero. Subscribe and follow us on social media. futurenetzero.com. Better business, better planet.